Welcome to episode 60 of the Mountain Land Running Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Heiderschreit from the University of Wisconsin Sports Medicine, but I am minus one co-host of Jeremy Stoker. He apologizes he's not able to join us today, but hopefully we'll be back for the next round. Reminder, registration is open for the 2021 Mountain Land Running Summit, September 23rd and 25th at the Sheraton Park City in Park City, Utah. Reminder, this is our sixth annual event. We've had a lot of fun the first 5 years, and we're going to do it again the sixth. We have a fantastic lineup of speakers ready to share the latest running medicine research. Keep an eye out for further announcements, and of course, check in at summit.mlrehab.com. As always, send questions and feedback to podcast@mlrehab.com. We appreciate your feedback and look forward to any suggestions on future guests. So today we are going to talk about bone stress injuries with Dr. Stuart Warden from Indiana University. Dr. Warden is a professor within the departments of physical therapy, anatomy, cell biology, and physiology, and biomedical engineering at Indiana University. Associate Dean for Research within Indiana University School of Health and Human Sciences, and Director of the Musculoskeletal Function, Imaging, and Tissue Resource Corps within the Indiana Center for Musculoskeletal Health. He has contributed over 140 publications and has a particular interest in the effects of physical activity on the skeleton. Dr. Warden has received funding from the National Institutes of Health and Department of Defense and been the recipient of awards from the American College of Sports Medicine, the American Society of Bone and Mineral Research, and Orthopedic Research Society. He currently serves as Associate Editor for the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy and Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise, and is a member of the editorial board for five other journals. Welcome, Stu. Thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Brian. It's good to see you again, and you know, looking forward to a good discussion.
Absolutely. Well, you guys have been really productive as always, but in the last couple of months, it seems like you put out a really couple of great papers that resonate with our audience, our listeners, in terms of bone stress injuries and prevention and management of those issues. So that's what we want to get into today. But before we jump into that, I was hoping you could share a little bit of your background about how do you get into skeleton health? You said that in the introduction in the bio, we talked about the effects of physical activity on skeleton was your interest. Where did that come from?
That's a great question. Really, it started when I was doing my physical therapy or physiotherapy training in Australia. I decided I wanted to get into research, and I asked around about projects, and Professor Kim Bunnell had this idea of treating bones with ultrasound. And so I sort of got into sort of bone, became a bonehead, straight out of PT school and did my PhD. And it sort of evolved from there. I came over to the States in 2002 to do a postdoc with, at the time, the world leader in how bone responds to mechanical loading, and sort of did some animal work and then transitioned. I wanted to, he said, you need to go and look at the molecular pathways. And I said, I don't understand those at all. I want to go the other way. I want to go to humans. So then, I sort of got into how does bone respond to exercise in humans? And as part and parcel of that is, stress fractures, bone stress injuries.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, I'm very thankful you did decide to go the other way, because I think your contributions to the field have been pretty darn impressive, and certainly has influenced a lot of current practice strategies that are happening.
Thanks. Yeah.
So the two papers that we're talking about here, your co-authors, Brent Edwards and Rich Willey. I think the three of you guys co-authored each paper. It's a nice kind of set of papers, separate journals. One is in Current Osteoporosis Reports, and one is in Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy. One dealing more with the prevention side, and one dealing more with the recovery side, the management side. Is that correct?
Yeah. The paper in Current Osteoporosis Reports talks more about how to adapt the skeleton to try and prevent bone stress injuries. And then the paper in the Journal of Orthopedic and Sports Physical Therapy is more of a clinical intervention. If you have a bone stress injury, and it focuses primarily on tibia and metatarsals, as they account for more than half of these types of injuries, what do you do when you have one of these types of injuries? Yeah. So they sort of bookend each other, looking at the two different parts, pre and post sort of injury.
Yeah, exactly. And it almost seems like, anybody who works with bone stress injuries, they're going to want to read both papers because both have really valuable information relative to their clients and their patient load. It's not just about trying to manage the injury, because usually when we're dealing with management of injuries, we're always automatically trying to deal with prevention and if minimum preventing the recurrence of it. So yeah,
that's important, particularly with bone stress injuries, that if you are managing these people with these types of injuries, you have to be thinking prevention from day one as soon as they walk in, because we know the data's out there that if you've had a bone stress injury, that's the biggest single risk factor for a future bone stress injury. So unless you start thinking prevention, it's going to happen again.
Yeah, exactly. So another commonality between the two papers was in the title. You use the phrase optimum workload or optimum load. Can you put that in context? What is bone workload, and then how do you determine what's optimum?
That's a great question. And workloads is this sort of fancy word these days. It's the word that everyone's throwing around, whether it's bone, tendon, whatever, whether it's physical ability, what sort of workload. And workload primarily sort of refers to what we've traditionally thought about exercise, is how hard you're working and for how long and so on. But when it comes to bone, there is no one sort of single definition, but it really comes down to what the bone is seeing at the bone level. So if you think about your shin bone or tibia, the workload is really at that tissue level. And we know that bone stress injuries sort of develop because bones get this micro damage, which is a normal phenomenon, but they get these little cracks. And when they form, it depends on how much load or how much you're bending the bone and how well the bone can resist that. So when we talk bone workload, we're talking about at that sort of tissue level. One is what forces are being applied to bone, whether it's gravitational, muscle, or any other types of force, and then how well does that bone sort of resist it and be able to tolerate that load. And so when we talk about workload and bone stress injuries, and so coming back to sort of the definition, it's basically the interaction between how often you load a bone and how high the magnitude is. And that's sort of what we sort of watch to try and work out sort of where someone is in terms of injury risk. And that's sort of in the prevention side of things.
Yeah.
And that's different for if you're recovering from a bone stress injury. The optimal workload there is, say you're symptomatic, is trying to get the workload that makes you asymptomatic. So, for example, if you're walking around with an active sort of bone stress injury in your tibia, the optimal workload is the one that doesn't cause symptoms. So it's sort of the two parts. The sort of prevention is working out what load the bone can tolerate based on how often you load it and how high the magnitude of the loads are. And then if you're injured, how do we unload enough that it becomes asymptomatic and then progressively increase that load as it tolerates it.
So on the prevention side, then I would assume that the optimum, this idea of optimum load, I struggle with trying to understand how we can define that based on some external markers of where the athlete or the runner is, right? I mean, because I would assume not all bones are created equal, and a person's history probably influences how strong their bones are by the time they may begin running and so forth. So are there strategies that you have to kind of decide what's a good starting point?
Yeah, and that's, this is the ultimate question clinically is, we know that optimal load at the tissue level, that's how we sort of work out, what causes bone stress injury. But how do you do that clinically? What do you look at clinically? And like you said, it is looking at history. And one of the big things is to look at historically what that person has been able to tolerate in the past, and looking at how much they've been able to advance or progress their training in the past without basically getting injured. Yeah. And, a lot of people talk about acute and chronic workload ratios, looking at the most recent sort of week versus the past 4 weeks. But really for bone, you want to go back in time and work out, and this is where good documentation comes into it with each athlete, or logs of what they were able to change in the past and tolerate, and what were they, when they got injured in the past, why did they get injured? What did they change that made was the trigger? And how do we modify that next time so that we are more progressive, or we're smarter about, you know, introducing that sort of new activity or progressing that load? So it is really looking historically at triggers and looking at what an athlete has been able to tolerate in the past. And you know, that's fine for someone who's been running for a long time. But if you get someone who's, you know, going from couch to 5K, you know, who's not an athlete, what's the optimal load? You know, you don't have any sort of benchmarks, and that's, you know, that is tricky. And like you said, different people are going to be able to tolerate different changes in workload and different changes in their training and not get injured. And so, you know, that sort of is their starting point. You need to start documenting when they start getting off the couch. What could they do before, you know, hopefully they don't get injured, but what could they tolerate and continue to train?
Yeah. So from a standpoint of bone health overall, and you compare across sports and different athletes, where do distance runners stack up against athletes from other sports?
Well, running, you know, if you think about running, how sort of monotonous it is, if you're thinking sort of long distance running, half marathon, 10K and the like, it's pretty monotonous. And so you're doing the same thing over and over and over again as you're running. And we know from the basic science of animal models that the bone cells that respond to mechanical loading, that adapt your bones, they basically become deaf after about 100 repeated loading cycles. And if you think about that, if you go out to run, how long does it take you to do 100 cycles on one leg? It's basically 200 steps.
Yeah,
it's not very long. And so after a short period of time, the bone cells basically say, hey, we've seen that load, you know, we're bored, you know, and they basically shut off. And so distance running inherently is not a great bone building activity. And if you couple that with any sort of you know, particularly in females, menstrual dysfunction or males and females, you know, low caloric intake, you know, not taking enough calories, then you end up with these sort of not very good bones for repeated loading. So running itself is not a great bone building activity. You know, the bone cells do become responsive again, but it does take a number of hours.
And so if you compare that to an activity or a sport where there's multi-directional loading, I assume, like the, like you mentioned before, that the bone cells may not be as bored as quickly.
They may not be as bored as quickly. But if you think about the multi-directional sort of sports and activities, basketball, soccer, things that have, you know, changing direction and so on, the bone cells do become deaf, but they're being exposed to higher loads, quicker loads, loads in different directions. So you're loading different parts of the bone that, you know, one part of the bone may become deaf, but then you load a different, another part of the bone, and you're loading different surfaces. And basically, you know, what we think is that if you're doing these types of sports, particularly before puberty, because before puberty, that's really the only time you can increase bone size, make a bone bigger, and be able to resist external forces. So if you do these sports before pubertal growth period, then you can develop a more robust bone so that you can resist loading later in life. And there's multiple pieces of evidence that support that, particularly with bone stress injuries in the military. Those sort of military recruits who played ball sports before they joined basic training have a much lower risk of bone stress injury than those who never played ball sports. And the thinking is that they have a more robust skeleton.
Mm-hmm. And so when you are trying to increase bone mass or bone density, whichever term metric you're using, and you'll probably correct me for using the wrong one, then please do so. When we think about periodization from a muscle strengthening standpoint, do those same principles apply toward bone growth and bone changes?
They do. And, you know, everyone talks about bone density and bone mass because, you know, that's sort of osteoporosis and bone strength, and that is important. But when it comes to exercise, I like to think a lot more about bone size. So how big the bone is in cross section, because the more you distribute your bone material or mass away from the middle of the bone, then you get a much disproportionate increase in strength. And we've shown in former Major League Baseball players who have retired that they maintain their bone size benefits of pitching, of throwing in their throwing arm for their whole life. Even though they haven't thrown for 50 years, their bone stays bigger and stronger because of the bone size, but the bone mass goes away. And so you've really got to develop that bone size before puberty. And once you've gone through your pubertal growth period and you've reached skeletal maturity, it's really, there's really no evidence that you can then, you can increase the size of a bone. You start adding mass on the inside where it's not as mechanically beneficial. But coming back to your question about periodization, it's important for bone as well, because not only do the bone cells become deaf within 100 cycles or so within a single period, they also become fairly deaf over a training block as well. And one of my colleagues in Indiana once showed this in an animal model, that when she exercised some animals for 5 weeks, then gave them a 5 week period off and then exercised them again. So basically they got 10 weeks of exercise. Those animals had much greater adaptation than animals who were loaded for 15 weeks continuously. So even though, you know, the 15 week continuous group got 50% more loading, they had less adaptation. And what we think is that during that first 5 weeks, the bone cells got used to that loading. Then when we stopped the loading, they went back to their baseline sort of, okay, no loading. And then they were more responsive again when we started loading again. So in terms of applying that to athletes and runners, is you should really incorporate periodization and have time off. You know, whether it be a week every eight weeks, or whether it be, you know, a month, a year, or whatever, you need to have some time off to allow those bone cells to resensitize to the stimulus.
Is it fair that you could take you could modify the amount and the intensity of your runs as time off per se, or do you truly need to be in that more unloaded state in order to see these sort of effects? In other words, could somebody go from being 40 miles for a week and just have a down week where it's at 15 or 20? Would that be enough to have that recovery?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. There's no studies showing looking at whether you reduce the load versus take it away. And, you know, and by a rest week, we don't say don't do anything.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you transfer to cross training, whether you do a week of riding, water running, you know, something that maintains your cardiovascular sort of fitness and benefits, but really doesn't result in that impact loading to really give those bones a rest.
Got it. And so one of the things you had mentioned in the articles was about if you're trying to build bone, recover, that you want to progress training duration before intensity. And can you explain that a bit more? And then, and what's the reasoning for that?
Yeah. So, and this works for a number of different tissues, particularly for bone, is that you really want to get a base sort of volume. And, you know, a lot of coaches out there have this mileage volume in their head, and everyone talks about mileage, and really mileage doesn't really matter that much, but you do want to get some sort of base mileage as an easy pace before you start thinking about adding intensity and adding speed. And from a bone perspective, there's some principles behind that. And basically, for your risk of a bone stress injury, as you increase how many times you load a bone, so really if you think about mileage, how many steps you take, it's a one-to-one ratio. So basically every step you take increases your risk by a certain percentage. But if you increase your magnitude, it's a disproportionate, more of an exponential relationship. So as you increase your intensity or loading magnitude in the bone, your risk of bone stress injury increases disproportionately. So for a small increase in speed, you get a disproportionately greater increase in risk of bone stress injury. So it's much safer then to increase your distance at a given speed than to start, you know, introducing a lot of intensity work. And so you build up that sort of base, that training sort of base of loading. And then once you think about, okay, I want to start adding intensity, you can drop your mileage for that week, add in the intensity, so your bone workload's not going through the roof, and then build up to that same volume again at the new intensity, then drop it back when you increase your intensity again. And it's sort of this alternating, you know, increase duration, drop it back, increase intensity until you get to a certain duration again. And you know, you're getting all those training benefits in terms of advancing your training and progressing, but you're doing it in a smart sort of way.
So is the increased risk of, so that's greater when you're increasing intensity, is that because of the increase in forces that are applied to the bone with increased intensity, so, whether it's muscle or gravitational, as you mentioned before?
Yeah. So when you increase your speed, we know you increase your ground reaction forces.
Right.
And whether it's ground reaction forces or whether it's muscle or whether it's a combination of both that causes bone stress injuries, we do know that as you increase your intensity of training, and by intensity, we usually talk about speed, you know, speed work, that you are increasing your bone loading and your bone loading rates, how fast the bone's being loaded. And that does increase your risk of bone stress injury more than if you increase the length of your training session.
Okay, got it. All right, so now we got the kind of the foundational pieces put together. I'm sure there's more. So, but this is only a 30-minute podcast, so we can't go into all the background detail. Listeners always want to hear what do I do about it? What are some recommendations? So, if we're looking to improve bone health in non-injured individuals, if we're trying to prevent the BSIs from occurring, what are some of your key recommendations for people?
Well, if we do it sort of across age, you know, if we start young, the first key thing is avoid sport specialization early. And, you know, that's easy to say now, but if it's hard to do if you're older because it's too late. But if you're training athletes now who are young, middle school, elementary school, and so on, they shouldn't be running year round. They should be doing, you know, cross country during cross country season, then going off and doing other things. And you really shouldn't specialize in distance running really until you get to high school. And it comes back to adapting your skeleton. So getting that robust skeleton. And we see this across a number of sports that people who specialize too early, they might be the best in the country, but they disappear because they start getting injured in high school and college and they never make it to the higher levels. Particularly, you know, classical example is baseball. Kids who are throwing too early, throwing too hard, they don't make it to the majors because they've burnt out and they're injured. And the same happens with runners. So the first thing is get your young athletes doing other sports and building not just bone, but building musculoskeletal sort of coordination and stability and so on throughout the whole system. Mm-hmm. Once you are past puberty, like I said earlier, it does become harder to adapt the skeleton. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean you can't do it, but you're not going to really develop a bigger bone post-puberty. And so if you've got someone who they want to increase their bone health, they're worried about bone stress injuries and so on, then we sort of use a plyometrics type approach because we know bone sort of responds best to high magnitude loads that are introduced at a high rate of loading. And so plyometrics really uses the muscle to load the bone, and your focus in the training is really the active push off phase. It's not landing hard. You should be landing soft. It's really the pushing and the concentric phase that you focus on. And so if you have a runner come in, you know, for example, today who says, okay, I've had bone stress injuries in the past. I really want to, you know, increase my bone strength or focus on some bone strength exercises. You know, the go-to is plyometric type exercises. But you have to be smart about introducing them. They can't continue with their current loading program or their current training program, and then you add on top of it plyometrics because you're going to overload the bone. So you really have to give up a training session to introduce something new. You can then progress the training, they're running back up again once you know they can tolerate the addition of some plyometrics, but you want to introduce them while taking something away. And some athletes don't want to do that, but if they've got the time, then it really does help. And it doesn't just help with the bone side of things. You know, we know that any sort of muscle strengthening is going to increase their speed and increase their even their distance running. So that strengthening in the legs, the power type activities will load the bone and be beneficial, but it's going to help their running as well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So what are your thoughts about vitamin D, calcium supplements, things like that, in the non-injured state?
You know, that really comes down to a personal sort of approach, in the sense that you've got to decide, do I really need that? And that comes down to doing a nutritional sort of analysis as to, are they taking in enough calcium? Do they have enough vitamin D? And so you can do some blood work to look at vitamin D levels. And yeah, in most runners, vitamin D is not a big issue because they're running outside, particularly in summer. You know, yeah, they've got abundant vitamin D. But, you know, I don't get too much into vitamin D and calcium. You know, we look at their diet and make sure that they're taking in enough calcium. And if they are, then it's okay. There's no point adding supplements. It's just a waste of money. But in those who are definitely deficient, then yeah, they can help.
And does that advice change at all for the injured state, or is the same advice carried forward?
It's exactly the same advice. Yeah. You look at, you know, if you've got someone who's drinking a ton of milk, having cheese and yeah, yogurt and so on, then I'm not worried about supplementing their calcium. Yeah. You know, they didn't get a bone fusion because they don't have enough calcium. It's more of a workload. And most of the time you can go back and you've got to remember that these bone stress injuries don't occur because of what they did yesterday. Yeah. It's what they did 3-4 weeks ago. And so you've really got to go back. And this is where good documentation about training programs is important. And it takes 3-4 weeks for sort of the symptoms and the bone to become symptomatic. So you've got to go back a month and look at what happened a month ago that might have been a trigger that brought on this type of injury.
Yeah. And so when you are managing load and as part of the recovery from a bone stress injury, you know, there's two parts to that question. One is, what do you do when they're in the non-running state? You know, is there certain activities that you recommend they do? And then the second part of the question is, what is a good return to running program? Because those seem to be pretty anecdotal and pretty variable in terms of what's out there.
Yeah, and you're correct. Well, let's start with the, you know, what do you do before you're starting running? And the first thing is you want to get someone asymptomatic. Yeah. And if they're walking around their house and they've got symptoms just with daily living activities, then you've got to think about, okay, do they need some sort of assistive device, crutches, or do they need a boot for a few days? You know, I don't like boots. I find that they cause more problems than they're worth. And, you know, people certainly just slap on a boot and go, okay, I don't have symptoms now. You know, I just leave this boot on and I'm fine. But you know, we might use a boot for a few days just to get them asymptomatic. And then let them walk around the house again, you know, not going for walks with the dog, just, you know, doing laundry and so on, and see, have their symptoms settled. So really trying to get them asymptomatic. Once they're asymptomatic for about 5 days, where they haven't felt their sort of bone stress injury just during normal activities, then we start looking at introducing the return to run sort of programs. And like you said, they are sort of anecdotal because there really are no published ones. You know, I only know of a couple that have been published, but they haven't actually been studied. Right. So they've been used as the gold standard in some studies looking at other interventions, but they haven't actually been shown to accelerate or facilitate someone's return to running. But they make logical sense. You know, as opposed to having an athlete where they have a bone stress injury, you say, okay, I don't want you to run for 8 weeks, and then they become asymptomatic and then they go off, okay, you're healed, go off and run. Right. You know, they're going from no load to back to normal training, and bang, they get another bone stress injury. So these return to running programs is more about introducing a progressive load so that when they get back to their sort of normal training activities, that they've got some sort of base that they've built up from. Yeah. And, you know, like you said, there's lots of different varieties. You know, one that we often use is basically a 30-minute program per day, where the first day is just a 30-minute walk. You go out for a 30-minute walk at your normal walking pace, and you want to make sure you have no symptoms during, after, or the next morning. You know, it's really, you've got to think about the next morning. When they wake up that next morning, do they have any symptoms? If not, they go into the next phase. And the next phase is often 9-minute walk, 1-minute jog, and doing that 3 times. So you're doing basically 3-minute jog. And we're talking jog, you know, we're talking 50-60% normal pace. We're not talking running. And again, you monitor symptoms. They can tolerate that. You go to the next phase and you sort of work through until you get to 30-minute continuous jog. And so that's, you know, a program that we like to use. It's been found to be useful in terms of patients can get through it. They don't generally go backwards very often. If they do, they only go back a certain phase or a certain level. And they can progress up to a 30-minute run, and then you start making it more individualized for individual athletes.
What do you think about for somebody who is going to be non-running for, say, a 4 to 6 week period, say, for example? Do you recommend... And let's say they become asymptomatic to normally ADLs or activities of daily living within the first 7 to 10 days, 12 days maybe. Do you recommend doing any sort of muscle resistance training during that time when they're not running? Or is that considered, and if so, do you strengthen muscles that attach near the site of injury, or do you try to avoid those?
We do strengthening early, and not just strengthening. We do get people doing water running, cycling. You know, with the cycling, you know, if you've got a metatarsal bone stress injury, you don't want to be pushing through the ball of your foot. So we put them in something more solid that, and put their foot forward on the pedal, so they're not putting bending moments through that metatarsal. So they can still cycle, but not load the injured site. In terms of strengthening, we do strengthen across the site. You've got to think about what muscles to work and what it's doing to that bone stress injury. So if you think about the tibia, most of those bone stress injuries are along the posterior medial sort of inside of the shin, and that's sort of under compression when you're doing calf work. So you can do some calf work because you're not going to open up, you know, cause tension on that bone stress injury. But again, it's all within symptoms. We're not going to do heavy loaded calf raises. We're going to start pretty easily with TheraBand, even in you know, sitting, and then progressing even double leg calf raises as they can tolerate, and just monitoring symptoms. So as long as they're asymptomatic while doing it, then we do allow it to take place. Working on quads definitely is going to help, particularly when they come back to running. That, you know, if they don't maintain their quads sort of strength, they're going to land differently. When they, it's going to change their mechanics, and you know that, all of that. So if you're going to do some quads work, we're not going to do squats that are going to load through that tibia. We can do open kinetic chain sort of knee extension work, and you can also put the resistance above where their bone stress injury is. So instead of having it down at the ankle and creating bending moments on the tibia, move it above where their injury is, so you're not loading that injured site.
Yeah, nice. Well, I'm curious to hear about what kind of future projects you've got going on, because you always have cool stuff happening. So do you have anything new and upcoming you want to share?
Yeah, sure. I can throw some things out there. One of the cool things that has happened sort of in the bone field more recently is this development of the high resolution CT scanners. And these CT scanners, they scan at 10 times higher resolution than a normal clinical CT, but their radiation dose is less than a bone scan, a DEXA scan. So it's like living in a major city for a day. And so you can image all the way down to different, to trabeculae, and you can look at bone porosity and so on. So we were fortunate enough, we have one of these machines, and so we've been playing with it. One study that we have going at the moment is interesting. It's coming back to that question of if you exercise as a young kid before puberty, does that give you bigger, stronger bones once you reach college? So we're looking at female collegiate athletes who played soccer and basketball and so on when they were younger versus those who didn't, versus those who just ran and looking at their bone size and seeing some pretty interesting stuff, particularly at the metatarsals, not so much at the tibia, which, you know, we thought we'd see lots of stuff, but the metatarsals, there's definitely some big differences between those who played ball sports and those who didn't. So it's sort of just providing some more background evidence there of the benefit of exercise before, you know, before puberty. And then we're starting to look at how these bone stress injuries heal. What, you know, one of the big things or things that's lacking in this field is any studies looking at how do bone stress injuries heal and what can you do and when can you do it? And how do we monitor the healing and decide based on the imaging, you know, can they do something, you know, what sort of activities can they do? So we're looking at using the scanner to monitor just the longitudinal sort of how do these bone stress injuries change over time? What do they look like when people go back to running? Are they healed or are they not healed? So really just developing some almost descriptive information that, you know, will guide us as to, okay, this is how a normal bone stress injury heals before someone goes back to running. What can we do to change that? Can we accelerate it? Can we do something else earlier? So we need to know a lot more about the healing phase of things.
That's great. Yeah, like you said, I mean, it may just be descriptive, but boy, is that necessary right now, because we don't have a clue what's going
yeah.
on.
Yeah, and it comes back to your question before, how you know, what's the best return to running program?
Yeah.
Well, unless we have some metrics, right, and know what's right, going on at the bone level, how do we compare different programs? You know, so that's the, you know, it's an open field. There's so much to do in this area, and so little evidence at the moment.
Well, Stu, thank you so much for taking the time. Really appreciate you jumping on the podcast with us and sharing what work you've got happening and all the great stuff you've already got going on.
No, anytime. It's been great, and good talking to you again, Brian.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Well, that brings us to the end of today's podcast. On behalf of my co-host, Jeremy Stoker, we'd like to thank you for tuning in. And as a reminder, don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. Registration for the 2021 Mountainland Running Summit is now open. So check out the full programming online at summit.mlrehab.com. As always, you can find more information on all the running medicine resources offered by Mountainland Physical Therapy at mlrehab.com/run. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Exercises that are safe and appropriate for some people may not be for you. No treatment program should be undertaken without first consulting your physical therapist or physician. The contents of this podcast is protected under United States copyright laws and may not be reproduced, redistributed, transmitted, displayed, published, or broadcast without prior written permission of Mountainland Physical Therapy.